Ruth's is a seemingly insignificant little book compared to some of the larger books in the Old Testament. When I was in seminary, majoring in Old Testament and Hebrew, this was one of the very first books that you had to translate and study. So I've been through it at that particular level and enjoyed it back then. When you study this little book, it has a spiritual truth that you need to embed into your mind as you approach it. The truth is this, that in times of great personal and national darkness, God is always working behind the scenes to accomplish something spectacular. And that's what you see in Ruth, as we're going to understand her times. So her times were extremely wicked in which she lived. It was the period of the judges, as we will see. And it's a time of great moral chaos. And just when you thought times could not get any darker, God showcases this gem of a story. How many books in the Old Testament are written in favor of women? We just studied the other one. Esther was the other one, and now we're studying Ruth. So women should feel good this year. We're really nailing how God works through great women. And it would make an interesting study to do a comparative study between Ruth and Esther if you just look at them as women and how God used them, because they come from different places. Because Ruth is going to be a Moabitess, not a Jew. Esther was a Jew, and God's going to use both of them to accomplish purposes that are awesome. So to understand this particular first chapter, I'm going to cover the entire chapter this morning. I want to look at it from a structural perspective and make some notations as we go along, and then guide you toward basically a central theological motif, a little bit different than how I typically construct a sermon. And I usually do a background study of the book before we start a book, but I'm not going to do that today. So today we're charting new ground. So what I'm going to do is first look at what I would call the setting of the book, which occurs in verses 1 and 2 of chapter 1. It says in chapter 1, "Now it came about in the days when the judges governed that there was a famine in the land, and there was a certain man of Bethlehem in Judah. He went to sojourn in the land of Moab with his wife and his two sons." So from that particular setting structure, we learn a couple of things. Number one, we learn that the book was written during the period of the judges. So you should automatically ask yourself from a Bible study method standpoint, when was that? That was 1406 to 1390 BC. So the Israelites have been given the land by God. They've wandered 40 years in the wilderness. They finally are getting to go into the land of promise that God gave them. God told them to rid the land of the people who had polluted the land. In fact, if you read Leviticus, Moses says that the land was ready to spit the people out. Their wickedness was so great. So God gave him the land, and through the conquest, through Joshua, or Yeshua is his name in Hebrew, he's the great Christ type, they are supposed to take the land of promise. So they take it, but the only problem is, after they took it and began to build cities and build businesses and do farming and get well, the people became very lazy once they were blessed. And they enjoyed the materialism that they had achieved in the land. And so they decided that they weren't going to eradicate the people that God told them to eradicate from the land. They were going to leave them there. Good idea? Bad idea. It is a very bad idea. If God tells you, or if your doctor tells you that you have cancer, and because I've had, I think, 9 Mohs surgeries, so whenever they tell me you have an issue here, you need to address this. If I just told the doctor, "Hey, let it go, man, no problem. We'll just come back in a few years." You think that's my approach when I go in there? No, I'm like, "How soon can you schedule this?" And you want to get it eradicated, because if you don't eradicate it, it's going to come back and plague you. And so Israel, they were plagued all through the period of the judges by all of the peoples that they had left in the land, came to oppress them. And when you read Judges chapter 21, verse 25, the close of the book of Judges, it summarizes the entire period of the judges from 1406 to 1390 BC. What were those days like? In those days, there was no king. They had no leadership. What happened when there was no leadership at the helm of the nation? He tells you what happened. Everyone did what? Right in his own eyes. Sounded like something from the 1960s. You just say, "Hey, I just want to do my own thing." Still alive today. If there is no absolute law and people don't respect the law, then they then create their own law. And when they create their own law individually, you balkanize a nation, and the nation begins to fracture and attack itself. Sound familiar? That was the period of the judges. Terrible time to be alive spiritually and morally. Just terrible as the nation was disintegrating. And enter the story of Ruth. It's a beautiful little story. J. Siddle Baxter calls it a silver star in an inky sky. Did you hear me? I don't talk like that anymore, but I thought it was kind of interesting. A silver star in an inky sky. So a black sky, and there's this one bright little star. That's how God works. So whenever you look at the news and get depressed and fret and worry, you'll always know that God's sovereign hand is always on the wheel, guiding things where they need to go. Through all people's ups and downs and nations' ups and downs, there's always a story of Ruth. Or if you're a man, it's probably Russ. I'm just saying. Guys are thinking, I'm totally left out of the equation. No, just apply it to yourself. So the second thing that we learn, the first point was it occurred during the period of the judges. Point number two, it was a time when famine struck the land. When you study the concept of famine in the Old Testament, you will realize that God typically used famine, especially in Israel, to bring judgment to his people when they disobeyed him. He would get their attention. Leviticus 26 is a blessing-cursing chapter based on the Torah, so that if you obeyed God, God would bless you. If you disobeyed God, God would curse you. He would discipline you. Similar to the motif in Hebrews chapter 12, where it says, whom the Lord loves, he chastens. He chastens sons. So when you, if you have children and your child walks away and does the opposite of what you've told them to do, this willful activity is not met with you thinking, isn't it wonderful what they're doing? Honey, don't you like their willful disobedience? No, you usually move some kind of swift retribution to get their attention, correct? And so that's why God doesn't work any differently than that, because he loves you and you want them to grow up. And so so God would use the concept of a famine to get their attention. Now, when you read the book of Judges, which I would submit that you do read the book of Judges to help you understand the book of Ruth, you'll run into chapter 6. In chapter 6, the Midianites, one of their enemies that were left in the land, they didn't eradicate them, so they come back to haunt them. And so they're reigning over Israel for 7 years, and what they would do is every time the Israelites would plant crops, they would come in and destroy them. Wherever they grew crops, they would decimate their fields. And if you do that enough to agriculture, pretty soon you have no food. And so scholars believe that the book of Ruth occurred sometime during that particular time when their enemies that they didn't deal with came back to haunt them, and it caused a famine. Third thing that we learn is the famine that was probably caused by enemy activity caused one particular family to leave Bethlehem. Now, this is really interesting. Bethlehem is composed of two words in Hebrew, Beit, which means house, Lechem, which means bread. So you put them together, it's the house of bread. Don't you find this ironic? The place that is called Beit Lechem, house of bread, has no bread. Now, who's going to be born in Bethlehem eventually? No, before Jesus. David's going to be born in Jesus, because we're in Bethlehem, because we're going to run into him in chapter 4 when we get there in August. I'm serious. When we get there, you're going to find out that this book culminates with the birth of David in Beit Lechem. So the house that was supposed to have bread had no bread because of the sin of the people, but God in his wrath always remembers mercy. So down the line of people is going to be eventually born David. And then from David, if you read Matthew chapter 1, is going to eventually come Jesus, who's going to call himself in the book of John, the bread of life. So the time of scarcity was designed to get the attention of the people to cause them to lean on God. But one family decided, we're not sticking around. We're going to leave and we're going to move to Moab. Not the best choice. It says in verse 2, and the name of the man of the family that was mentioned in chapter 1, verse 1, his name was Elimelech. The name of his wife was Naomi. The names of their two sons, not names that you would choose, I'm sure, Malhon and Kilion. What particular facet of the tribe of Judah were they from? Well, they were Ephrathites. And we'll talk about what that means. This is stuff you just typically read through when you're reading through a book, right? You just need to slow down and pay more attention. Elimelech, what is his name? His name is My God is King. That's what his name is. So every time you say Elimelech, that's what you're saying in Hebrew. My God is king. He's the leader of this little family. If you were a father right now, we need to talk to you for just a moment. Have you ever in your marital life made a decision that you absolutely regretted? No one's talking. Yeah. And you're thinking, what in the world was I thinking? I knew God wanted me to do this. It was hard. I couldn't do it, so I did this. This is not one of his greatest life decisions, to take his family to Moab, because, it says he's an Ephrathite. Now, what does that mean? Well, Ephrat, the person Ephrat, that's a female name, was the wife of Caleb. Do you know who Caleb was? So when they sent the spies into the land to determine after the 40-year captivity whether we could take the land or not, the 10 spies come back and say, we can't do it. The fortifications are too great. These people are too tall, and there's no way we can do it. Two spies, Joshua and Caleb, said, oh, we can absolutely do it. God is with us. We can do it. Caleb became one of their great warriors. His wife, Ephrath, became the leader of the Ephrathites. So this clan inside the tribe of Judah are well known as warriors. They're like the special ops. Understand special ops here? Yeah. Everyone knows them. You would think that if anybody's gonna stick around for the fight, to fight famine, it's gonna be those folks. What did Elimelech do? Hey, famine's too great. We're gonna move to Moab, our enemy. Good decision, bad decision, bad decision. Now, I'll tell you this, and we're still on the introduction. We'll eventually get to the book. When you make a bad decision, because we all do as men when we lead, sometimes we do, God can take the mess that you created in your bad decision and do something marvelous with it. Because that's what this book's about. So don't go out of here sulking today going, I am totally toast when I get home and my wife brings up what I did. Don't do that, because God works even in through those gnarly things that you have done to create great things. Now, as a side note, as we look at the fact that the father made a really bad decision to move his family to their enemy's territory, Moab, which would have been 50 miles to the east of them across the Jordan River, he also has he has two sons, right? Mahlon and Chilion. Now the Moabites, we need to stop and just talk about them for a minute, because Ruth, who's a key person in the story, is a Moabite. She's a Gentile. Naomi's the Jew. The Moabites, who are they? Where did they come from? Noah, remember Noah? Okay. So Noah, if you look down through his particular family line, you're going to eventually get to a man named Lot. And Lot had two daughters. And his two daughters, after the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah in Genesis 18, in chapter 19, Lot's two daughters began to look at, well, all of the young men were wiped out in Sodom and Gomorrah and the other cities, Admah and Zeboim. Who will we marry now? So they decided to get their father, Lot, drunk, because they used to live in Sodom, remember? And they got their father drunk, had relations with him, and from those relationships came, this incestuous relationship, came the Moabites and the Ammonites, Israel's ancient enemies. So the mistake of these two young girls is gonna form two nations that are become Israel's avowed enemies. And all you have to do is read the book of Deuteronomy to understand just how much these people groups hated each other. Well, that's the setting of the book. So out of this nation that were their enemies comes a beautiful story, a love story, of a Moabitess that the Lord is going to show grace to, and he's gonna use her to accomplish great things for himself. Now we wanna actually get into the book. That's just the introduction. So you ready? Yeah. So we wanna look at in verses 3 to 5 what I would call the ruination. It says in verse 3, then Elimelech, Naomi's husband, once he got to Moab, what happened to him? He died. And she was left with her two sons. And those two sons, by the way, especially in the Jewish culture, were a sign of God's great blessing to give you two sons. And they took for themselves Moabite women as wives. Good decision or a bad decision? Bad decision. The name of the one was Orpah, and the name of the other was Ruth. And they lived about 10 years in Moab. Then both Mahlon and Chilion also died, and the woman was bereft of her two children and her husband. Imagine this. Elimelech makes a bad decision. Let's get out of the famine here and move to our enemy's country. I know they worship Chemosh, and we're not supposed to marry with them, and let's move there, find some food. Why do you think he died? What did the Torah say? I'll bless you if you follow me. I'll curse you if you do not follow me. The Lord probably took him out because he willfully went where he was not supposed to go. Eventually, the two sons die. Why? Because the compromise of the father became the compromise of the sons. And so he compromised, and so what did they do? Well, they're in Moab. There's no Jewish women over there. These are young men, and they're looking around going, these Moabite girls are pretty. Why can't I date one? And so they dated, and they got married. According to Ruth chapter 4, verse 10, Malhon married Ruth, which means Chilion married Orpha. After 10 years, those two young men died. Why? God probably removed them for their compromise. They willfully shook their fist on God's face and said, my dad compromised. Nothing's really happened to us. We'll compromise and marry Moabite women. Even in that compromise, in God's discipline of those men, God is sovereign. So even when you shake your fist on God's face and God disciplines you, realize he still loves you and he's still sovereign. Lamentations 3:38 says, is it not from the mouth of the Most High that both calamities and good things come? God is in control of both things. Because if he's not in control of both things, then he's not sovereign. Daniel chapter 2, verse 20. Daniel answered and said, let the name of God be blessed forever and ever, for wisdom and power belong to him. It is he who changes the times and the epochs. He removes kings, establishes kings. He gives wisdom to wise men and knowledge to men of understanding. God raises people up for certain things. He removes people and moves them on so other people can step in and do things. God's sovereign. He's constantly in control. Even when you've compromised and he has to discipline you, he's still looking beyond that discipline to how can he use you to further his kingdom causes. So the family traveled to Moab, their enemy's territory, and one compromise led to another compromise, led to God dealing with his people. The resolution in verses 6-7, verse 6 says, then she arose with her two daughters, because all she has after 10 years are two daughter-in-laws and three graves. That's all Naomi has. So it says she took her daughters-in-law that she might return to the land from the land of Moab, for she heard while she was in Moab that the Lord had visited the people in giving them food. So she departed from the place where she was and her two daughter-in-laws with her, and they went on the way to return to the land of Judah. So this is about a 50-mile trek from the mountains of Moab down into the Jordan Valley on the north tip of the Sea of the Dead Sea, across the mountains, going up to Jerusalem, and then going up about 10 miles or so down to Bethlehem. She got word somehow that there was food back in Bethlehem after she lost her husband and two sons. So she went back to the land that God had told her, that's your land, you should be there. What you're gonna find is God's gonna step in again, and he's gonna work in Naomi's life with all the bitterness that we're gonna see that she has, and he's gonna work in her life to do some major blessing on her life that she never anticipated. Naomi had two fellow travelers. Who was walking with her as she headed toward Bethlehem? Orpha and Ruth. They're going with her. They're from Moab. They're heading to Israel. That took some doings for them to head in that direction. I'm sure they were sorrowful as they went along. And so when we get to verses 8-9, Naomi's gonna present a request to them. It says, Naomi said to her two daughters-in-law, go, return each of you to her mother's house. May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with me, dealt with the dead and with me. Now think about this. Ruth and Orpha were heading to Israel to be part of a faith community of the living God. I mean, the word Shaddai, El Shaddai, the powerful God, the Lord as the powerful God, that's what's used in this chapter when it describes God. They're moving from false gods, Chemosh, to the true God. Why would she tell them to go back to Moab? You know, if Ruth was truly walking closely with the Lord, or not Ruth, Naomi, I don't think she would have told them to go back to the idol-worshiping land of your mother and your father. Warren Wiersbe makes an observation that I think is true when he says this. Why would a believing Jewish, a daughter of Abraham, encourage two pagan women to worship false gods? He says, I may be wrong, but I get the impression that Naomi didn't want to take Orpha and Ruth to Bethlehem because they were living proof that she and her husband had permitted their two sons to marry women from outside the covenant nation. In other words, Naomi was trying to cover up her disobedience. If she returned to Bethlehem alone, nobody would know that the family had broken the law of Moses. Remember? the law called them to stay in the land and tough it out and watch God bless. They decided to leave, and then they compromised once they got over there in Moab. It wasn't like today that once they move there, they got iPhones and they can send text messages and Instagrams. Everybody knows everybody's business. I mean, back then, 50 miles might as well have been 5,000 miles. But I think Wiersbe is correct. And that particular counsel to those two young ladies shows that Naomi had been kind of polluted by living in Moab. What's the response of the young ladies? Verse 10, they said to her, "No, but we will return with you and your people." They said, "We're not going anywhere. We're gonna go with you." Now, Naomi is gonna turn and tell them in verse 11, "Return, my daughters, why should you go with me?" So she's gonna give them all the reasons why they don't wanna move to Israel, where the living God is. You think she would wanna take them with her. She says, "Have I yet sons in my womb?" Answer, No. "That they may be your husbands?" "No, I don't have any. I'm not pregnant and my husband's gone." "Return, my daughters, go, for I am too old to have a husband. If I said I have hope, if I should even have a husband tonight and also bear sons, would you therefore wait until they're grown?" I mean, if I were to get a husband somehow and I was to get pregnant, you wanna stick around until they're old enough to marry? You're gonna be too old and they're not gonna marry you because you're too old. So why would you wanna follow me? "Would you therefore wait until they're grown? Would you therefore refrain from marrying? No, my daughters, for it is harder for me than for you, for the hand of the Lord has gone forth against me." This is interesting. She realized that God was disciplining her. Why? Because they moved to Moab. They didn't stick it out through the hardness, and they moved when they should have stayed and fought it out. What tribe were they from? Well, the tribe of Judah, but the clan of the Ephrathites. And so they had fled, and then they compromised once they got into the land. And so she's telling them, you need to go back to Moab, to all your gods and all that goes on there. And it says in verse 14, the young ladies lifted up their voices and they wept again. And Orpah kissed her mother-in-law, but Ruth clung to her. So it's totally different, the responses to the young women. Orpah gave her mother-in-law a kiss, as we're going to see. Then she leaves and goes back to Moab. What's Ruth do? She's like white on rice, right? She's all over her. She's like, you're not leaving. You're not going anywhere without me. I'm coming with you. You can't shake me. Don't you find this ironic? What is going on here? You have a Gentile, a Moabite, hugging on a Jew. This is amazing. Can't I go with you? What you're beginning to see is God is all about healing the nations. He's about healing ethnicities, problems between peoples. God is all about that. He's going to take their avowed enemy, a young lady from that. And when we get into this later, it's possible that she was related to the regal side of the Moabites, because later when David's the king, he's going to go to Moab and they're going to accept him down there. And the theory of scholars is they accept David down in Moab for protection from Saul, because in his lineage was a regal relationship, which was traced back to Ruth. Something to think about. We'll get into that later. The Gentile wants to go to Israel. So verse 15. Naomi said, "Behold, your sister-in-law has gone back to her people and her gods. Return after your sister-in-law." See how she's been affected by Moab? You have to be very careful of the culture that you live in, that it does not stain you. She's stained. In verse 16, Ruth said, "Do not urge me to leave you or turn you back from following." And this is, I don't even know how many times I've used this in weddings before. What does she say? "Where you go, I will go. Where you lodge, I will lodge. Your people, they shall be my people. Your God, my God. Where you die, I will die, and there I will be buried. Thus may the Lord do to me, and worse, if anything but death parts me and you. I am sticking close by you." This is interesting. In Naomi's spiritual compromise, you find that God worked through that spiritual compromise to get the attention of her Moabitess daughter-in-law. Ruth is a believer. You would have never thought she would be, but she comes to know God, and she wants to be where the Lord's land is and be with the Lord's people. And she said, "Nothing will keep me from going there." So Ruth watched her mother-in-law lose her husband, but Ruth knew that God was still with them. Ruth watched God take her beloved husband, but he also understood that God was still with her. What faith she had. And she's beginning to teach Naomi about walking close with God. So she said, I love you and I love your God and I will desert neither. I'm going with you. Verse 18, when Naomi saw that she was determined to go with her, she said no more to her. Translated, argument was over. She's taken her with her. The return in verses 19 to 21, it says, so when they both went until they came to Bethlehem. Remember how far was it? About 50 miles. And it came with various terrain elevation changes. And it came about when they had come to Bethlehem that all the city was stirred because of them. And the women in town said, is this Naomi? Have you been to your 10-year high school reunion? I was, you know, because it's been 10 years, you know. What happens to a person after 10 years? Now, yesterday, every 3 months, I get together with two of my friends that I grew up with. They're probably watching this sermon. David, who's, I think he's the comptroller for the state of Idaho, and Ward, who's an attorney at a law firm where he's a partner in Los Angeles. And so we grew up together, and we get together. It's funny, I told Liz after I talked to my friends yesterday, it's like, you look up and then think, I remember in my head when they were, you know, 15, 16, and now they're men, and they look different, right? You don't. In your mind, you're thinking, I still look like I'm 18, right? You're thinking that. But what happens in 10 years? Just go to your 10-year reunion. I mean, I had people walking up to me going, hey, Marty, what's going on? It's good to see you. I'm like, who are you? One of my friends that I grew up with, we were both born at the same hospital at the same time, same day, everything. Joe Catania was his name, Italian guy. He came up to me at my reunion. I didn't know who it was. I'm like, the eyes look familiar. Sorry, I don't remember. It's like Joe, man. What do you think happened to Naomi after 10 years? Weight gain. It happens, right? Weight gain. Skin's weathered. It's now a little more weathered. Hair, hey, she used to be a brunette. Now she's, I don't know, she's kind of white haired. I don't know. Is that her? Could it be her? So they're the talk of the town. Who's the girl with her? Is that Moabitess? Unbelievable. How did Naomi respond? Verse 20, she said to them, don't call me Naomi, call me Mara. For the Almighty, Shaddai, has dealt very bitterly with me. How does she feel about God? She's got some feelings. I went out full. She means that I had sons and a husband when I left. But the Lord has brought me back empty. Why do you call me Naomi? Because her name in Hebrew means to be pleasant. Oh. She said, don't call me pleasant anymore. Call me Mara. Because Mara in Hebrew means to be bitter. Why do you call me Naomi? Since the Lord has witnessed against me and the Almighty has afflicted me. Does this sound like a positive view of God? No. Because that word there, witness, the word witness in Hebrew, it's a legal term in a court setting. And what she's saying is, my husband, we talked about it. We decided to leave the land of promise and we fled at a time of famine and we went to Moab. We shouldn't have done that. And while there, I lost my husband. I lost my two sons because they married Moabite women. And I've been drawn into God's courtroom and God's brought the evidence against me and declared that my actions and our actions as a family were sinful. And so he judges accordingly. And because of that, I have a bitterness about that. Here's the thing. If you have sinned and walked away from God, he's still working in your life in ways you probably can't even comprehend. Because even in all of that bitterness, God is looking down and saying to Naomi, oh, I got a surprise for you. And it's going to come through Ruth, a young lady you did not even anticipate. It says in verse 22, so Naomi returned with her Ruth the Moabitess, her daughter-in-law, who returned from the land of Moab. And they came to Bethlehem at the beginning of the barley harvest. That's interesting. Barley harvest occurred around April to May. So think about it. They left when there was no harvest. Now they're returning when there is harvest. This is the first hint in the book that in wrath, God's going to remember mercy. And in wrath, God's going to always work to bring blessing on you. What does this teach us? It teaches us many things. Them arriving at harvest time was not by accident. Because if you know the book, Ruth is going to go glean in the field of a man because they're poor around the edges of the perimeter of the field to find food. And she's going to run into a young, good-looking man named Boaz. that is eventually going to become her husband, and God's going to bless her and bless Naomi in a spectacular fashion. Just neither one of them knows it. Where is Naomi at? She's dealing with the bitterness of the decisions that she's made, but God's like, I see your tears, and I'm going to bless you. And it's going to shock you when I do it, and it's going to be through Ruth. What do we learn from that entire chapter? Here's what I learned. Here's what I walk away with when I look at it. God strips us down in adversity to do what? To build us up for greater purposes. What would the devil say to you? God's through with you. You made the terrible decision. It's over for you. You're useless to God. No, that's not from God. God whispers in your ear, just read the story of Ruth. Yes, they sinned. Yes, they compromised. But I used adversity to get their attention. I broke them down, and now I can use them greatly. That's your story. That's my story. That God uses adversity when you sin to strip you down, but then to build you up because he has some great things on the horizon. You just need to make the decision to head back to Bethlehem, the house of bread, because maybe you're in Moab. And so when you head back to Bethlehem, anticipate God doing some amazing things in your journey that you did not anticipate. Let's stand. God, we bow before you. Your thoughts definitely are not our thoughts, and your ways are not our ways. How great you are, and how great your love is to us, your loyal love, as we see in this first chapter. You're always working behind the scenes to correct us, to move us to greater godliness, and to shape us to do great things for you. And even in Ruth's situation, you reached down into a very godless culture and saved that young woman. And I'm sure there's a lot of people here today that are online that can relate to her. They need to have a faith relationship with you. And you're going to do many things in their lives to draw them unto yourself. May they see that and turn to you in faith. We bless you, and may our lives truly reflect the fact that we follow you no matter what. In Christ's name, amen.